Exploring local knowledge has been at the heart of African studies for a generation, particularly since the critique of centralised, top-down, scientifically based development first flourished in the late 1970s. It has been an especially strong focus for studies in medical, agricultural and environmental history, the fields of most direct concern to us. The roots of these concerns, of course, lie in anthropology. In her famous ethnography, Reaction to Conquest, 1936, Monica Hunter suggested that there was little distinction between natural and supernatural explanations of disease in 1930s Pondoland, or between a therapeutic and magical understandings and methods of treatment. She also explained that much space has been devoted to witchcraft and magic, but it is commensurate with the part they play in Pondo life. The belief in them permeates the whole of life. Reading some recent books on witchcraft in South Africa and beyond, such as Niehaus and Ashforth, one could come away with a similar impression. It is difficult to be sure about the 1930s, but our research into African local knowledge about livestock diseases, their causes and treatments, suggests a more complex and changing picture. Our research indicates that natural, but not biomedical, explanations of disease are now more significant than supernatural, and that the form of the latter may have changed. South Africa is a land of animals. Livestock was central to rural society, and until very recently, many South Africans owned or worked with animals. They continue to play an important role in the lives of black families, both urban and rural. While a small percentage of African homesteads own livestock, the number in absolute terms has probably not declined. And in villages such as Mboiki and Pondoland, it is probably still over 50%. Cattle and goats have a social and cultural value as well as an intrinsic economic worth. For these reasons, farmers have observed the health of their animals and experimented with different ways of preventing and curing diseases. Local veterinary knowledge has constantly evolved, incorporating new ideas about causation and treatment. This remains a central rural concern, but it is a neglected theme in the academic literature. Our talk is based on a book, In Progress, that is a first attempt at an overarching view of contemporary African veterinary knowledge in South Africa. Arguably, it is one of the most important fields of local knowledge, and just as our thinking on these issues requires an interdisciplinary approach, so local knowledge is, in a sense, multi-layered. From the late 19th century, veterinary science became an important tool of government policy. The state became highly interventionist in controlling livestock movements, organising a national campaign of compulsory dipping against tick-borne diseases, a major scourge in South Africa, and introducing vaccines for infections such as anthrax. During the homeland era, at the height of apartheid, from the 1960s to the 1990s, central control over veterinary services declined, and dipping became irregular in many places. After 1994, the ANC government curtailed national veterinary provision. Due to budgetary constraints and other priorities, less money has been invested in regular dipping or systematic vaccines. This has created the perception that ticks and some diseases are on the increase. Richard Masweswe from Mboiki recalled, "When I was a boy herding, you seldom saw ticks in the felt. If you saw a tick, you would get excited and call the other herd boys over. Now, if you walk through grasses, your trousers become black with ticks." And you can see some pictures there of the damage that ticks can do. They eat away the udders and ears, etc. And that's a picture of a dipping tank, which was the usual way of dipping animals, really until the 1980s. And in some areas like the Eastern Cape, it's still a common way of dipping animals to deal with ticks. It is anomalous that the state has partially withdrawn from veterinary provision at the very moment that more land is becoming available to African livestock owners. Most of the redistributed land is used for livestock rather than crops and managed under forms of collective ownership. This trend is likely to continue, and the number of African livestock owners will probably increase. Some wealthier African farmers graze hundreds of animals on the common land, but the majority, possibly over a million, possess less than 10 head or a small flock of goats and sheep. disease is an ubiquitous problem and one of the biggest obstacles all farmers face. In this context, an understanding of African livestock owners' approaches to disease becomes especially important. In a sense, any livestock-owning settlement in the country was a potential field site for us, but we did try to seek diversity. So I worked in the Northwest Province, which is an interesting area because of a large range of poisonous plants. There's a lot of ticks and also bacterial diseases such as anthrax. These are high veld areas with a mixture of savanna and bushveld grasslands, getting drier the further west you go towards Botswana. As an environmental contrast, I also worked in the former homeland of Kwakwa, which is now in the Free State, and it's a mountainous zone lying in the shadows of Drakensberg. The third major case study was in Boiki in Pondoland on the east coast of the country, formerly in the Transkei, where William had researched on rural history and resistance in earlier years. Mboiki was close to some of the largest indigenous forests in South Africa, providing a rich range of medicinal herbs. The area is also famous for its ticks and traditionalism. Additional information on local knowledge in the Eastern Cape came from a trio of other investigators who unfortunately aren't here today. In total, we interviewed about 200 stock owners. And although we have a reasonable density of interviews in a number of sites, we have not conducted systematic village-level observations over a long period. This, no doubt, impacts on the quality of material that we deploy. And we were largely reliant on people's reports or descriptions of what they thought and did in relation to the identification and treatment of diseases. Colonisation, population movements, and the overwhelming presence of an authoritarian state for most of the 20th century have infused older strands of local knowledge with a wide range of new influences. Throughout the 20th century, African farmers were exposed to the practice, if not always the theories of biomedicine. Biomedical incursions were not always welcome, but they were nevertheless influential and had an impact on African understandings of disease causation, treatment, and animal husbandry. For example, concepts of hybridity and pluralism have been central to the writing of recent African medical history. For example, Fireman and Janssen have pointed out that African medicine is essentially adaptive and draws its knowledge from multiple sources. The literature on human medicine has, in some respects, moved away from studies of polarities between local and scientific ways of knowing to an approach that explores how medical knowledge is generated. The focus is on cultural exchanges and the evolution of pluralistic medical systems. For example, Karen Flint's recent monograph on the development of Zulu medicines during the colonial period exemplifies this genre. She showed how medicine provided a forum for cultural exchange and colonialism helped to create a multi-therapeutic society. Despite state support for Western medicine, there was no shift towards biomedical hegemony. Africans negotiated this new medical culture rather than accepting its epistemology and practices in total. There are strong echoes of such interchanges in the veterinary sphere, and our interviews reflected the limits of Western biopower as a cultural force. Knowledge did not always pass with a dip. One of the most striking findings is that even farmers who use vaccines and modern drugs did not necessarily accept the etiological explanations that might be expected to inform the administration of these therapeutics. Despite the fact that most of those interviewed were now enthusiastic protagonists of dipping, relatively few African livestock owners accepted that ticks transmitted disease. They saw ticks as troublesome, but not as vectors of infection such as gall sickness and heart water. Rather, they saw these diseases as consequences of seasonal environmental changes, or occasionally they attributed them to witchcraft or other supernatural forces. Farmers who invested in the latest vaccines, anthelmintics for worms, and poron acaricides for modern treatment for ticks, might also ban women from handling livestock because they adhere to beliefs that women can undermine the fecundity of animals or bring misfortune to the cattle kraal, the cattle enclosure. Terms such as hybridity, pluralism, and bricolage are useful vehicles for explorations of such multidimensional understandings, but they also have their limits because everything is hybrid. Both scientific knowledge and local knowledge were evolving rapidly at the same time as they were implicating locally. It is more difficult to capture the precise makeup of plural knowledge systems across a wide range of individuals, the relationship, interrelationship between different forms of knowledge, and the general direction of change. Rural knowledge is fragmented, and to use a currently popular anthropological concept, sometimes uncertain. As Frederick Bach reminds us, people within a single group may participate differentially in multiple social knowledge, and branches of knowledge are distributed differentially across groups of people. Discussions of local knowledge sometimes tend to imply that this provides coherent understandings of, or even solutions for, many of the problems that arise in rural communities. Roy Dilley has raised the potential significance of ignorance in the discussion of knowledge. Transmission of local knowledge is by no means an open and effective process. Our interviews did not indicate a sense of fatalism about treatment, and many were convinced that the remedies were effective. But some people are unconfident about older methods and insufficiently convinced of new forms of diagnosis and disease control. Even when they do accept the latter, they can seldom afford the most effective drugs and dips, which exacerbates their sense of insecurity. Some accept that their strategies are suboptimal, and particularly with respect to tick control, admit to being relatively powerless. Our overall impression from interviews is that natural and environmental interpretations of disease were the most significant. In all the areas we visited, livestock owners were particularly attentive to the quality of the felt. Historically, seasonal transhumance has been an important strategy, although now largely curtailed, and practiced only on a limited scale around Mboki and Kwakwa. In Kwakwa, stock theft has deterred many farmers from sending their animals to cattle posts in the mountains for summer grazing. Transhumance reflected a strong environmental conceptualization of disease that linked good health with nutritious grasses. Interpretations of disease and good health were associated with the seasons, weather conditions such as drought, and the state of the felt. Gall sickness, a tick-borne disease prevalent throughout the eastern half of South Africa, was probably the most common disease identified. Swana-speaking informants who called it gala often attributed it to the condition of dry grasses or else shifts in the composition of the felt from dry to verdant or vice versa. They thought that animals could not cope with these changes, so the gallbladder became blocked or else bile drowned the digestive organs. Constipation ensued, and animals lost their appetites, eventually dying of emaciation. Similarly, in Mboki, farmers saw the source of Nyongo as lush green pastures in the spring and summer months, coinciding with a period in which ticks became active. Nevertheless, none of the Mboki informants associated Nyongo with ticks. Seasonality is therefore an important concept when explaining the prevalence and distribution of conditions such as gall sickness. Nonetheless, in all our sites, informants thought that the absence of ticks helped ensure a good appetite, an indicator of good health. Livestock owners identified diseases by looking for primary symptoms, the consistency of the stools, the nature of the gait, the state of the nose or ears, or the appearance of sores and lesions on the skin. If an animal was constipated and had a dry nose, for example, it might be suffering from gall sickness. And now some pictures to put you off for your dinner. Farmers often carried out post-mortems, William, whilst butchering the meat for human consumption. In a sense, local veterinary diagnosis differs radically from human medicine and possibly opens the way for explanations based on observation and natural causes. From the autopsies, an inflamed gallbladder confirmed death from gall sickness. An abundance of fluid around the heart pointed to heart water. Blood oozing from the orifices suggested anthrax. Whilst the stinking carcass indicated black water as the flesh begins to putrefy before death. Explanations of disease could be monocausal, or they could involve a range of ideas, depending on the local situation and the informant. An example of a multi-causal explanation appeared in Lot Matung's discussion of black water, which is a cattle disease. In his experience, severed swine could result from tick bites, from rotten carcasses that polluted the felt, from changes in the texture of grasses, and from humans urinating near the cattle kraal, having eaten meat from an animal that had died of blackwater. His account reflected some understanding of contagion and a realization that some diseases could circulate between humans and animals. Ma Taiwong's testimony also highlighted the importance of environmental factors when deducing the source of disease. Respondents did not generally attribute disease to witchcraft, but under certain conditions, some invoked malevolent forces. This seemed more likely if animals died suddenly in a kraal, or if only one owner experienced losses, as his or her, she felt particularly targeted. Interviewees who thought that they had been victims generally blamed jealous neighbours for these inexplicable catastrophes. In Mboiki, one particular set of symptoms was associated with witchcraft. These symptoms were rapid death, blood oozing from the mouth and nostrils, and internal hemorrhaging in the lungs when the animal was opened up. Informants explained that the animal had been struck by a witch's familial, Tokoloshi. The symptoms seemed to bear some resemblance to anthrax, and it may be that the disease tends to strike individual owners unpredictably because most animals are inoculated. Sometimes farmers believe that their animals have been bewitched because their protective medicines or muti had failed. This might result from an evildoer deploying stronger muti, or it might be a consequence of ritual pollution. This term, ritual pollution, used in ethnographies, is uneasy because it applies very largely to a gendered view of misfortune and seems to reinforce patriarchal controls of space and property. A number of our Swana informants explain that menstruation or widowhood could be detrimental to livestock. In Kwakwa, the majority of our informants refused to allow women into the kraal or to handle cattle because their mere presence could destroy the protective muti. Although witchcraft was not widely offered as a reason for sickness and disease, a more ambient form of supernatural explanation did come up frequently. In both the Northwest Province and Mboiki, this was associated with words for footprints or traces, the concepts of Mahato and Mkondo, respectively. Neither of these terms appear in the ethnographies, and it may be that they are new terms, or at least their meaning may have changed. We are thinking about them as hybrid supernatural concepts, drawing both on older ideas of witchcraft and pollution, as well as newer ideas of infection. In the Northwest Province, Mahato was associated with women of childbearing age and widows who carried the shades of their dead husbands and could cast misfortune and infertility on the cattle kraal if they approached livestock. There appeared to be no knowledge of diseases like contagious abortion, which leads to miscarriages in cows. We were particularly interested in whether respondents had observed any evidence of the harmful impact women could have on livestock. Their response was often a reiteration of custom and belief. In most cases, it was an article of faith rather than a direct observation, although it was clear that they associated abortions and livestock with the footsteps of women, whatever its cause. Most people found it difficult to explain the concept of Mahato, but Nakuta Nkwetsi, a retired schoolteacher, best seemed to express its fluid meanings. She talked of a cross-infection, a biomedical term, between women and cattle, and also associated menstrual blood with the blood of slaughtered animals. Nevertheless, despite the many taboos against women in many families, some Sotho and Swana families do now allow women of all ages into the cattle kraal and to look after animals. The term Mkondo used in Mboiki also derives from a word for footstep or footprint, but in Pondoland, it was associated with the deposition of disease in the dew, often by a metaphorical snake, rather than by women. We came across it initially as an explanation for keeping goats in the kraal in the morning till about 10 a.m. when the dew had been burnt off. If the goats went out earlier, they would fall sick. Thus, this concept includes elements of natural explanations of disease, but it is also associated with a range of rather indefinable symptoms attributed to a more ambient supernatural force rather than to witchcraft or nature itself. People treat Mkondo by placing herbs in the ground around the homestead or burning muti in the centre of a kraal. However, unfortunately, we can't write the history of these ideas. Although many diseases were seen to come from external sources, ill health and a propensity to contract disease could emanate from within. Several Swana interviewees explained that a state of wellness depended upon a balance of bodily fluids, quite similar to pre-germ theories in Europe. Too much bile caused gala. Too much blood could lead to liberty or anthrax, causing blood to seep profusely from carcasses. Some interviewees treated a sanguinary excess by clipping the ears or making incisions under the tail whenever the livestock appeared unwell. Furthermore, they bled their animals from time to time to purify the blood, as dirty blood was said to destroy fertility. Pondo informants spoke of weak blood and believed that animals became very susceptible to disease in this condition. To overcome this, they dosed their animals with a herbal remedy to fortify the blood. By far the most common way of treating diseases was to dose animals with solutions made from plants collected from the forest or for felt. Bark, roots and leaves all featured in the muti. Most were given as solutions through the mouth. Doses would be repeated at intervals until they achieved desired effect, often of a purgative nature. Loose bowels and effective defecation were regarded as a general sign of health, so that a range of symptoms, and not only constipation, could be cured by purging. Gall sickness was widely treated in this way, although the specific mix of plant medicines differed in the various research sites. In the Northwest Province, aloes, which were ubiquitous, are the major laxative, whilst in Mboiki, a mix of four plants are pounded together into a solution. Informants judged whether a plant had worked partly on the rapidity and scale of excretion. Soft dung was the route to health. Plants could equally be used to treat some supernatural causes of disease, particularly the treatment of space around the homesteads. In Kwa Kwa, this could specifically prevent ills such as witchcraft or stock theft, but it could also be used more generally against less specific problems, such as mahato and the effects of women, or mkondo. Some livestock owners who administered herbal remedies believed in their efficacy, at least for particular diseases like gall sickness. For some, they were also a statement of cultural identity, an expression of skepticism about the safety of modern drugs. But some informants also voiced concerns that the disease environment was changing, and that the old treatments were no longer working so well. In such cases, they continued to use traditional medicine because they could not afford biomedicines. Many informants across all the research sites preferred biomedicines because they seemed to be more efficient, worked more quickly, and were more convenient to use. However, even more educated commercial farmers who largely used biomedicines would also resort to medicinal plants for dealing with birthing problems such as retained placentas. Scientific medicine also failed to address the issues of witchcraft, mkondo and mahato, and they often called on healers to the homesteads each year to protect the homestead through ritual healing. An eclectic additional range of treatments fell between the traditional and biomedical, including copper wire and a dewlap to ward off black water and anthrax, Jay's fluid, which is a disinfectant, and petrol to treat warts and tick damage, or tar to heal wounds and deter flies. So, conclusion. Farmers monitored ill health, closely observed the symptoms in live animals, and carried out postmortems. The interviews pointed strongly to hybrid and plural ideas about the cause and treatment of disease. Despite over a century of veterinary interventions, many black livestock owners had a very limited concept of biomedical causes. Their ideas were certainly hybrid, but except for those of high levels of education, they tended to attribute diseases to etiologies that would not generally be accepted in contemporary scientific terms. Contrary to the informing ideas in older ethnographies, ill health was largely related to environmental conditions. Moreover, while impurity and witchcraft could play a role, this seemed to be restricted to specific diseases such as abortions and possibly anthrax. There seems to be a reasonably strong differentiation between natural and supernatural causation, which may have developed since the time that ethnographies such as Hunter's were written. Simultaneously, new categories of causation, which we are calling the ambient supernatural, such as mahato and mkondo, seem to incorporate ideas drawn both from witchcraft and from biomedical notions about infection, although, of course, they are not biomedical ideas. These appear to be more commonplace than witchcraft amongst our informants. We did not find a strong sense that infections were caused by germs, parasites, or vectors like ticks, nor did we hear of developed ideas about contagion and immunity. Sick and healthy animals were generally kept together. With regard to treatments, there was more openness to and adoption of Western medicines than there was to biomedical explanations or causation. dipping is now widely accepted, even if its specific role in controlling diseases was not always appreciated. Biomedicines such as terramycin, an antibiotic, and Dectomax and acaricide were popular. Many livestock owners are prepared to mix biomedical treatments with other methods, including infusions from plants, saying that the two methods increase potency. Our overall impression pointed to a growing interest in biomedicines, but an incapacity on the part of poorer livestock owners to afford them. In this sense, the balance within hybrid and pluralistic approaches appeared to be shifting towards biomedical ideas, but this was an uneven process. The gaps in knowledge and uncertainty about the best treatment were striking in relation to some diseases. We judge this not only in relation to efficacy, but also the perceptions of livestock owners themselves. Our findings suggest that effective veterinary programs must take account of dynamic local knowledges and work with the ideas held by hundreds of thousands of African livestock owners. This is particularly important in contemporary South Africa because the areas available to black farmers are expanding. While we do not assert that all biomedicines are equally effective, available, or affordable, we are also not arguing for medical relativism. Clearly, some treatments like Aleph solutions are seen as efficacious, although a recent scientific experiment attempting to test this suggested otherwise. It is important that research continues on local solutions, and there are some local experts who are quite widely consulted for remedies and especially to help with birthing problems. But we think it is important to acknowledge the variability and limits of local knowledge and problems that might arise in its deployment in state-sponsored medical and development strategies.